think of me if I don't. The familiar sound of his disappointment triggers my perverseness like clockwork. Whatever argument I had thought to make, I know my father will take it as one more proof that I am weak. My jaw clamps shut. I turn on my heel, return to Jaffira, and kick a foot into the stirrup. On our own heads be it. Once in the air, I guide us down. Griff, the conspiring, sweating bastard, disappears under our wing. I feel Jeff's instinctive satisfaction, like a hawk trapping its prey, as she hooks talons into his shoulders. Because unlike these wilting dragons around us, my Jeff is flying just fine. Spurred, it seems, by a tip-off from my traitor lover. I don't know whether I'm more furious with Griff in this moment or myself. I hear, or perhaps only imagine, his grunt of pain. We rise up. And I scan the horizon, the villages speckling the hillside. The shoreline, dipping down to the sea, the clan casts, the nearest perimeter of Sailor's Folly. With Griff's life dangling from Jeff's talons, I feel the desire through my fury, as clearly as light piercing a blanket of northern clouds. I can't save you. But maybe someone else can. And of course, I want them to. We rise higher, scanning, waiting. Come on. We pass the point of a survivable drop. Still higher. Conqueror's mound shrinks below us. The wind picks up. Jaffira circles on the updraft, fighting to hold her position. If we drift, the fall drifts. The drop will land in the wrong place. The spectacle will be diminished. But I will have a different kind of spectacle. Come on. Come on already. Come, while this faint heart still has the wrong kind of courage. Griff shouts from below. I think we're high enough. The wind curls over us both. Not quite. Dilo, get it over with. His voice cracks. At last I see it. The flash of amber. And I dig my heels into Jaffira's flank below her wings. Now. Griff drops. Antigone Sir Ayla bursts through the cloud cover and dives.
Griff. It's madness that this is how it ends. In the air, when the air was always my best escape. How different it feels to fly when there's nothing between you and the ground but your own two dangling feet. I have never loved nor hated Dilo Sir Jaffira so much as in these stretching moments. And then I feel Dilo's heels send the jolt through her. Jif's talons release my shoulders. The wind rips the yell from my lungs, my inside somersault, the ground rises up. Death hurtles to meet me, hard as stone and as unforgiving. And I'm knocked sideways. Another set of talons hook my tunic and the belt at my waist. I'm staring up at the amber membrane of an Aurelian's wings. Hang on, Antigone shouts. My lungs are full, and I'm laughing with the shock of it. We're diving. Antigone strains her voice over the whistling wind. Aga and the little ones are safe, hiding on Thornrose Karst. Your grandfather's got the weapons ready in the villages. We've done the rest. She means the Drakthanasia and the muzzles. Through the haze of relief, I latch onto the only thing that matters now. Get me to Sparker! On it! Conqueror's Mound rushes towards us. Norsians and Dragonborn are scattering, and the Highborn Riders attempt with little luck to get their sodden, poisoned dragons airborne. Antigone aims for the manacled black hulk that is my beautiful Sparker, pride of the fleet. I can feel him bucking his chains, and I urge him on with my heart swelling. Fight them. Break them. Come to me. Iron screws burst from their bolts. Metal screams. Sparker rears, the broken chains of his neck collar flailing. He uses the leverage to slam his muzzle against the wooden pilings of the cart. The muzzle shatters. I feel the relief of our freedom separate my own jaws. And then I remember what I've got to tell Antigone. There's good news and there's bad news, but I've got about 2 seconds to say anything, so I pick the good. Because right now, good is all I feel. Antigone, your friend, he's alive.
What?
Duck's alive. Sparker's just below us, and I bellow the cue. He's in the Citadel dungeon. Drop now! Ayla releases me. I plummet the last 10 feet and slam onto Sparker's, bucking back. For a moment, I lie flat, winded. Then the joy of our reunion gives Sparker the last burst of strength needed. He rears, chains bursting, and I cling to his bare back with knees hooked over his wing joints. The air rattles back into my lungs. All I need. Sparker arches his back and bellows Storm Scourge fire in all its glory into the sky. I feel I could bellow fire too. We're surrounded by the stunned audience that came to watch our drop. Norsians shifting weight, Dragonborn staring, all momentarily stunned into silence. What will it be, Norcia? I roar. Leary Thornrose, puppet king of the Norsians, steps forward to face me, his face a painted mockery. Beside him, Rode and his mucus-encrusted Aurelian lurch like a swaying ship as the dragon growls at me. Good luck getting that one airborne, I think. But she doesn't need to be airborne to stick her maw in Bran's face and threaten fire. They've corralled the Norsian squires, dragonless, in the center of the mound, and their empty hands are raised over their heads. But the squire's eyes are on the horizon, and I know what they're waiting for. We will take no part in this treachery, the puppet king Leary spits. Someone points at the sky and screams it. Dragons incoming! I turn and take in the most beautiful sight of my life. Norsian dragons are streaming out of the citadel lairs. Under their wings, I hear myself laugh aloud, are painted the Norsian clan stars. The squires have done it in Wode, the blue battle paint of Norcia from a time before her conquering. Today the Wode is worn again, in a new way. On our dragons. The Norsian screams of fear turn to recognition. Wode, someone shouts. They're painted with Wode. They're ours. And they're unmuzzled, bellowing fire. The Norsian riders use the moment of distraction to spring for the dragonborn surrounding them. Bran launches for Rode, tears him from the saddle of his whining Aurelian, and at first I think he's throttling him until he snaps a chain from Rode's neck. His summoner was kept by Rode, the lord he serves. Until now. Bran brings his summoning whistle to his lips and blows into it like he's expelling a lifetime of held breath. He's not the only one. Fiona scrabbles with Roxanna. Moira claws at the chain, still twisted round Faemy's neck. And our summoned dragons are dropping from the sky like pellets of hail. Norsians and dragonborn alike shriek and cower at their fiery ascent. Get him! Rode screams. But even as his dragon turns her mucus-encrusted gaze on Bran and lurches toward him with fangs bared, Bran's Aurelian, Beria, lands between them. She seizes the other dragon's throat, sets her fangs into the soft scales, and brings them together with a crunch. Rode doubles over and screams. At the sound of his scream, the realization spreads. Rode, the great lord's firstborn son and scion of New Pythos, has been widowed. One down, the rest of the fleet to go. Rode is crawling away on all fours. The great lord Rhadamanthus, standing with his wife and younger son, looks as though all speech has stuck in his throat. The rims of his black eyes are white. Roxana, seeing what has happened, begins to scream like her brother. Her summoner has been snatched by Fiona. Her dragon thrashes, unable to get airborne, as the Norsians tighten ranks. Our puppet king backs away as if to fade into the chaos unnoticed, but not fast enough. Sparker pounces. His jaws close over Leary's head. When he's done, the Norsians have no more puppet king. Bran throws himself barebacked onto his Aurelian and lifts a fist. At their feet lies the dead dragon of the lord he used to serve. Norcia! Bran Serberia bellows. Norcia! The chant rings out, taken up by his clan, Turret, then Mine, the Nag, spreading as Fiona takes it to Nol, and is joined by Colleen from Kraken. The Norcians that surround me on the ground reach into their tunics and produce knives and cleavers that will not be used for kitchen work today. The roar of Norcian dragons shakes the earth, and the dragonborn run.
3. The Missing. Lee, Callipolis. When they lead me into the courtyard of the cloister, the palace residence of the guardians, we find the entrances guarded by Pythian dragon riders. A rider who looks to be in his mid-twenties greets us in the main courtyard. His hair is fair as flax, his body built like a farmer's, but his silver eyes look oddly familiar. The storm scourge crest on his armour is done in grey.
This him?
Leo, meet Edmund Greyheather, says Ixion, his tone bored. Captain of the bastard Grey Riders and your half-brother. Of all the events so far, this is the first to stop me dead. My father didn't have... Edmund's laugh is booming.
It always does come as a shock. We'll have more time to share family history later.
Edmund's been promised Farhall and its lands in the Restoration, Ixion informs me, like this is supposed to land a blow. No hard feelings, I hope, since you seem so bent on giving up your inheritance and killing my sister. He smiles pleasantly at me.
Shall I collect wristbands, my lord?
Edmund asks. For guardians, wristbands are both the designation of their elite class metal status as silver and gold, and their means of summoning. The whistle pitched to a frequency for dragon ears is built into the band. Taking them means they're cutting us off from our dragons. Ixion jerks a thumb at me. Let him do it. A bag is shoved into my hand.
Go on,
Edmund says, pointing at the solarium entrance. I can see guardians waiting inside, their faces blurred circles of pink and brown through the glass as they peer at the courtyard. I shove the bag back. I'm not taking their wristbands. Ixion, leaving the courtyard with a fist raised to his own summoner for Nita, turns back. Leo, we've got 2 dozen guardians to deal with, plus their dragons. We don't really need to keep all of them alive. So choose your battles, hmm? The bag remains in my hand, which has begun to shake. I reach for my own wristband to unclasp it first, but Edmund notices.
Keep yours on.
He shoves me toward the door, smirking.
Annie, New Pythos.
Your friend, Griff tells me as the island explodes around us. He's alive. He's in the Citadel dungeon.
Ayla's talons release him onto Sparker's back, and for a moment all we can do is drift on the wind. When Duck fell during the airstrike, we were so high above the ground I heard no sound on impact. He was lost in a burning building. All I ever saw of his remains was a bit of his cuirass that Griff took from the rubble afterward. So when Griff tells me he's alive, I don't believe it. Don't believe it as we race to the Citadel, leaving the erupting battle behind. Don't believe it. As Ayla scuttles down the side of the fortress, searching for the lowest windows, the ones with bars that betray a dungeon. We find the bars, a row of them. We call Duck's name through them. There's no answer. It's not true. It's not true. It can't be. At the end of the row of barred windows is a single door that opens as a sluice gate. The cliff wall is stained with trails of waste below it. The door has no handle from the outside, so Ayla sinks her talons into the old wood and yanks. It breaks from the wall with a soft crunch. We peek into an unlit corridor that smells of mold and human waste. It's not true. It's not true. It can't be true. I'll keep the mantra up to ward myself, protect myself from the disappointment that waits at the end of this corridor when I learn Griff is, must be, mistaken. I scramble off Ayla's back and into the stinking corridor, not believing. Don't believe as I hammer my way down the row calling Duck's name. A lifetime of training has taught me that to call the names of the dead, to wake from dreams they were alive still hoping, leads only to more heartbreak. I don't believe until I hear Duck's shaking voice in return.
Lee. I enter the cloister solarium with the bag to collect wristbands and find frightened faces turned up to me from every corner of the room. The guardians are still in the ceremonial armour that they were planning to wear to the assembly this morning. The Pythians must have corralled them here right before it began. Apart from a handful of riders recovering from the last air battle in the infirmary, and the few with outstanding missions that kept them from today's obligations, most of the Corps are in this room. Rock sweats in a corner beside Lotus. Corps is on his feet with his arms folded over fists. Power alone acts relaxed, his legs crossed on an empty chair, seated in a circle with Darius and a few other patrician riders. But the fingers he drums on the arm of his uniform betray his nerves. The door hasn't swung shut behind me. Edmund Greyheather stands, watching from the threshold. I can feel my fingers sweating on the bag. I'm collecting wristbands. I watch their expressions shift from relief at the sight of me to something else. Glances begin to fire. Doubts ripple across faces. I feel my own silver and gold wristband still on my wrist, attracting their gazes. Is that a joke? Kor says. For a second, I think my mouth is too dry for speech. Duck is being held captive in New Pythos. It was what Ixion told me when he landed on the Eyrie and surprised the people with bread. No talking, Edmund barks. But it's enough. Kor's eyes widen. He looks from Greyheather waiting behind us, to me and the bag, and gets to his feet. Right, he says, his mouth aline, and drops his wristband in. It seems to take an interminably long time for all of them to hand their wristbands over, and afterward, I have a hard time remembering what their expressions were. I can't remember if it's because I was avoiding their eyes or they were avoiding mine. When it's done, I hand the bag to Edmund Greyheather. Thanks, hey brother, he says brightly. Dragon tongue isn't a strong language for many of the guardians, but the term half-brother is elementary enough. I watch Rock's brows knit together at the address. Edmund remains standing in the doorway, preventing further conversation. A thump rattles the windows of the solarium and makes us all look up. Through the rippled glass, we can make out the outline of a second storm scourge settling in the courtyard. Edmund steps outside, closing the door after him to confer with the new arrival. In the split second that it leaves us, I turn to the core. Antigone, Chryssa, and anyone else absent from this room are on patrol. Deirdre looks puzzled. But I thought Chryssa was... On a mission to Deimos, the neighboring democracy. Bryce elbows her and Deirdre's eyes widen.
Oh,
she says. As to what Annie's really up to, Power's the only one besides me with any idea. But when I search his expression for indication of what he plans to do with that information, I find his black eyes as unreadable as ever. The door bursts open. Ixion and Edmund stand framed in it. Ixion lifts his voice. Good morning, guardians. I am Ixion Sunita, your restored lord, and I am not unmerciful. Not all of you will be executed. You won't even all be widowed. But I require loyalty. To that end, I will be conducting private interviews. Proceed, Edmund. Edmund, a cheery smile plastered on his face, now holds a scroll in one hand and an empty grain sack in the other. Darius Somira? He calls, like a nurse in a hospital waiting room. The room seems to hold its breath. Darius looks at his hands. Beside him, Power looks at nothing at all. They are childhood friends. I'll remind you that your exits are blocked by dragons on all ends, Ixion says. We can just as easily smoke you out. Power shifts in his chair. Darius pushes himself to his feet with shaking wrists. He's pale beneath golden hair, his usually proud posture diminished as he makes his way across the solarium to Edmund and Ixion. Thank you for your cooperation, says Ixion. Edmund pulls the bag over Darius's head. He lets out a choked cry of surprise. Deirdre shrieks. Edmund yanks Darius over the threshold and slams the door shut behind him. The sound echoes in the still room. Edmund returns a quarter of an hour later and calls another name. He produces another bag. There's no more talking after that. The ones who are taken don't return. Bryce, an Aurelian rider of the 32nd Order, vomits into the fireplace. Deirdre curls her face into her knees. The room slowly dwindles of occupants, until only members of the 8th Order are left, Rock, Kor, Power, and I, and one lower-ranked exception, Lotus. Where is Chryssa Ward? Edmund asks. On patrol? Too many of us say it at once. Edmund's brow raises and his lip curls as he consults his list again. Antigone, I take it, is also on patrol? This time, the group overcorrects to silence and halting nods. Well, there will be plenty of time in the dungeons to straighten those stories out, Edmund says, rolling his eyes. Kor Sutter? Kor gets to his feet. I want to see my brother. Edmund chuckles. That will depend on you. He hands Kor the bag. Kor looks down at it, his face contorting. Then he places the bag over his head himself. He allows himself to be steered from the room. Power, chin resting on a cupped hand, snorts softly. Lotus's fingers clutch at his curly hair where he waits beside Rock, who is shock white beneath his freckles. I stand, arms folded, with my heart in my throat. The door opens, and Edmund consults the scroll. Parsival Greylily? There is no one by such name in the Kor, let alone in this room. The surname, Greylily, is the bastard assignation of Skyfish House. Rock lifts his head, frowning. Lotus removes his hands from his hair and studies them. Then he turns to look at Power. Power does not move. Parsival? Edmund repeats. Parsival Greylily, bastard son of the Triarch Kit Skyfish, fostered by Hesperides House, rides a... It says here, Storm Scourge. Edmund's voice lifts with incredulity. Power twitches, rolls his eyes to the ceiling with an air of great inconvenience, and flows to his feet. I go by Power. Rock stares at him.
You're a bastard.
I think we all knew that, says Power with a twisted smile. In dragon tongue, he asks Edmund, Trust we don't need to bother with a bag.
Depends on if you can help us find the peasant first rider.
Power offers his most menacing grin. That bitch? I can try. No bag is placed over Power's head. He follows Edmund out of the solarium. Rock swears under his breath. Lotus closes his eyes.
You don't seem very surprised, I observe. Nor do you, Lotus answers.
No. Now that I consider it, it's the first thing I've learned about Power that makes sense. For all the ways he's looked down on people of low birth like Annie and Rock, the loathing I saw in his eyes when he learned I was Dragonborn was something more. Power was the son of a Janiculum housekeeper who had been abandoned by her baby's father to die in a poorhouse. Now I know that father was a Skyfish lord. No wonder he's borne a grudge against people like me. Though, not enough to stop him from leveraging the connection now. In grammar school, Lotus murmurs, he went by Parry. Rock looks up at me, the whites of his eyes visible and bloodshot.
Lee, that storm scourge, Ixion. His father's Crethon, isn't it?
I nod. Triarch of the West, Lord of Nearhall. Rock's fingers clench.
That means he's... I'm...
I know. As Annie remembers my father, Rock remembers Crethon. And where my father was known for being harsh, Crethon was known for being cruel. Rock's village was in the Near Highlands, under his domain. All evidence points to Ixion's having inherited his father's tendencies. And if Griff is any indication... Ixion will find the idea of one of his family's serfs riding a storm scourge just as abominable as his father would.
Rock, says Lotus, laying a hand on Rock's thick one. You will be fine, I swear it.
The door opens once more. This time, Ixion stands beside Edmund again, and Ixion is the one who speaks. His tone is playful and triumphant.
Richard Nearhall, serf.
Rock flinches. It's a feudal nomenclature I haven't heard since before the revolution. I step between Rock and Ixion, but before I can speak, Lotus gets to his feet.
His name is Richard Sorbast.
At the sound of the draconym, Ixion's gaze travels from Rock to Lotus.
Your Tyrann's son?
Lotus nods. He rolls his sleeve to reveal a clover-shaped cufflink.
The Order of the Black Clover.
The counter-revolutionary group that's been passing information to New Pythos with the help of informants on the inside of our ministry and, it appears, even inside the Guardian Corps. The dots fire, connecting. Richard Tyndale, the poetry professor who wanted me to reunite with my family last summer. Lo Tyrann, renowned poet laureate and Tyndale's friend, fiddling with a clover cufflink in a bathroom mirror as he asked for my help with a poem to honour the dragonborn dead. And now Tyrann's son addressing Ixion as if they know each other.
We made a deal, Lotus says. Richard won't be harmed.
Ixion smiles.
He won't, he agrees, if he obeys his lord. That wasn't...
Bloody sparkfire, Rock snarls, rounding on Lotus, his voice rising. Deal? Deal?
Lotus lifts his hands.
Rock, I can explain.
I'll give you 2 a minute, Ixion says. Come out when you're ready. He slams the door shut on us. But the other two hardly notice as their voices rise and clash. Lotus is talking about his father, about Dean Orthos and the Lyceum, about literary censorship and eroding values under Atreus, and Rock is shouting over him, How could you do this? with tears streaking down his face. It was you, I realize, in a pause where Rock catches his breath. Leaving information for the Pythians on the Island of the Dead. Lotus nods. How long have you been working with them? Lotus answers faintly. Not long. Only once it became inevitable. I knew I had to protect the ones I loved. His glance darts at Rock, who's glaring at the ceiling. The patricians are sick of Atreus. They want their libraries back. The literary censorship and purges of the revolutionary regime came as an unpleasant surprise to the elites who backed it and have been a source of discontent for years. But all the same. Rock slams a fist into the table. My freedom for a library! I'm having the same thought. Lotus waves an arm. Oh, don't be so dramatic! That's when the roof creaks. A shadow lowers outside the glazed glass window. It presses against the panes. They shatter like spun sugar, and we find ourselves staring at the snout of a dragon nosing through the full-sized window like it's a dog door. Freyda's Goliathan has landed on the roof of the cloister. Lotus, Rock, and I back away from the intruding snout. Shards of glass still clinging to the frame curl away from the heat of the dragon's scales like peeling paper. Smoke issues from nostrils the size of a tree hollow, billowing into the cloister. A few of them are still in there, Ixion says outside. A woman's voice joins Ixion's in the courtyard. Perhaps they could use a little encouragement.
Annie. I must have imagined I heard Duck's voice. I'm racing down a single long prison corridor that slopes up to a guard room. The smell of human waste, of decay, of mold makes the air heavy. My voice sounds raw, strained in my ears. Duck? Annie? Can I have dreamed it? I round the corner and skid to a halt. The darkness is complete, save for the light from the disposal chute whose door Ayla tore off. Cells that yawn into blackness are lined with bars on either side, except for one, whose grill swings on its hinges as if it had just burst open. And in front of me, in the middle of the corridor, silhouetted by the faint light of the open chute, stands Duck. He's gripped from behind by Roadhay Aurelian, who holds my gaze and a knife to Duck's throat. Sweat makes his face gleam. If I doubted for an instant that it's really him, my Duck, saved by some miracle, his effort at assurance convinces me. Sweating, shaking, he gasps, Annie, it's okay. My sweet Duck is alive. And he's about to get killed.
Shut up,
Rode shakes him. He looks feral. He stinks faintly of vomit. His breath is elevated as if he ran the whole way here. He is, I realize, freshly widowed.
I knew you'd come to save him, he says.
Every word seems to cost him effort.
This is only fair, isn't it? Fire for fire. You take from me, I take from you. Ixion was planning to make you watch this anyway.
I feel the hair on the back of my neck rise. A second thought blooms like darkness in my vision. Where is Ixion? Why haven't I seen him at all today? Not to mention the Goliathan whose princess he was purported to be courting. The squires assured me he and Freyda would be back in time for the drop, but they were nowhere to be seen.
We figured we'd drop this one again, properly, for your benefit. But this will do.
I can see blood beading on Duck's throat where the knife presses. This cannot be how I find him, how I lose him twice. Seeing my panic, Duck starts comforting me again.
Annie, it's okay. It's okay.
And then he grunts. The screaming in my ears is my own. Rhodes slumps backward on the floor as a third figure mounts him and stabs. She is screaming too. Duck steps free, massaging his throat, and turns slowly. A young woman closer to Duck size than Rhodes straddles the Dragon Lord, a knife in her hand that she drives over and over into his chest as she sobs. Blood is on her hands and in Rhodes' mouth. The woman's hair is long, matted, her limbs oddly crooked. I can only just understand the Norish that she pants.
For my brothers, for my sisters, for my mother, for my father.
And then with a choke,
for me.
Duck kneels beside her to pull her off him.
It's over,
he says, speaking Norish he didn't used to know.
It's done, Lena.
And then he looks up at me as he holds her. His face is splattered with blood, gaunt in a way it was not when I left him. Burn scars I don't recognize swirling up his neck beneath overgrown hair. But those kind eyes that I remember are the same. And the tentative smile he offers at the sight of me melts me with relief. He bends down with tenderness that I remember from the days when I was the one who needed his comfort, and lifts the woman's chin to look at him. His lips brush her cheek.
Hey, he says, smiling. There's someone I'd like you to meet.
They get to their feet, and I notice then how Duck, too, moves crookedly. How they are both angled like people who broke and healed wrong. Duck, his arm around her the whole time, introduces me to Marbelena, the girl the Dragonborn once dropped. Her face is shining as she looks at him.
We knew you'd come, she tells me.
Lee. Smoke seeps into the cloister solarium, gushing from the great dragon's nostril and smelling of sulfur. The trunk-sized tail swishes idly against the glass. Every time the Goliathan shifts above us, the roof creaks. They're smoking us out, Rock realizes, his voice faint. Classic. Straight out of the Dragonborn feudal handbook. Lotus is breathing through his sleeve.
I was trying to protect you, he tells Rock.
But I hear the uncertainty growing in his voice. A smoke out probably wasn't part of whatever bargain he struck with Ixion. The smoke is thick in our nostrils now. We're all coughing. Rock palms at his streaming eyes. You don't understand. There is only one way someone like Ixion will ever see someone like me. He reaches for the handle of the solarium door and curses as his palm burns. Rock, I say, and he turns. Numb horror has been replaced by a desire for something else. I'll stay in here with you if you want it. Rock inhales a shuddering breath. His bloodshot eyes fix on me, bright in his ruddy face. And I know he understands me and that, for a moment, he is tempted. Let this dragonborn blood fizzle and dry up in my veins, in the kindling of our guardian training center as it burns, in our hopes for this nation as it falls apart. Let me die with you. Rock shakes his head. Not today, Lee. He uses the sleeve of his uniform to turn the handle. Ixion and Edmund wait outside in the courtyard, accompanied by Lucian Orthos, the general's chief of staff, and half the protector's guard. Dwarfing all of them is the Goliathan, whose body folds over the cloister roof, scales glinting like tiles. A single lidless eye follows us like a lamp. The Basileian princess stands on the roof ledge beside it, her bronze helmet still covering her face, a full-length mantle shimmering over her shoulder. Perched on our roof, looking down on us, motionless, she might as well be a statue of a long-dead god, a queen from the Golden Age. Rock, who stumbled out of the cloister first, cranes his neck to look at the dragon overshadowing us, before turning to Ixion.
"Richard Nearhall, sir,"
Ixion says again. Rock screws up his face.
"My lord," he answers.
"Better,"
says Ixion, smiling.
4. To hope for no safety. Dilo, New Pythos. As soon as I see the dragons streaming out of the citadel lairs with woad on their wings, I know that in helping Griff, I've cemented the end of dragonborn rule and New Pythos. For a moment, high above, level with the wisps of breaking fog, Jeff and I watch our world crumble. Antigone saw Ayla dropping Griff onto Sparker's back, the woad blue dragons swarming over the mound, our people cowering, fleeing, as dragonfire rains down, and then we snap to our senses. Fame, Ethelo, father. We dive after them. It's such a mad scramble on the ground that it takes us a moment to even find Fame or her skyfish in the fray. They're under Moira's Aurelian. Moira, Fame's squire. Until today, a gentle, unobtrusive presence I barely thought once about. Jafira's blast sends Moira and her Aurelian sideways. "Get off her!" Moira's laughing as her dragon frees itself and kicks off from the ground. Fame's got blood dripping from her temple, but looks otherwise unharmed as she scrambles to her feet. "Where are father and Ethelo?" Ethelo, Fame's twin, is a Passos, forsaken by dragons, never chosen. He'll be on foot with father. Fame scrambles onto the back of her skyfish and jams her heels into her sides. "They're heading for the Invictory. Come on." Her skyfish, Hecate, whimpers and kicks at the ground as if it were holding her down. The sight of her skyfish hatchmate circling above her gets her off the ground with trembling wings. She joins us 15 feet above the fray, where we find one other dragonborn in the air. Roxana Hay Aurelian. What the hell's gotten into them? Rora feels like she's drunk. "So does Heki," says Fame, with a palm to her skyfish's slender, trembling neck. They're doing better than anyone on the ground. Rhodes' dead dragon has been gutted by the mob. As we watch, a woad-painted Sturm Scourge pounces like a mountain cat on a fleeing Hay Aurelian uncle. When the dragon turns, I see the rider on his back. Griff's face is smeared with blood, his grin a streak of white. Griff will have the retribution he has waited for today. They will sing about him like warrior kings of old. I will be a footnote, the failed executioner who set the stage for his triumph. But even knowing my own ignominy, I have a moment watching Griff glory in his bloodlust where all I can think is, he was born for this moment, and he's beautiful. I tear my gaze away. "They are poisoned. Drachthonasia." "We don't stock Drachthonasia," Fame says. "They probably got it from the Calipolan first rider. I saw amber scales on Thornrose cast this morning. I think she's been here for a while." For a moment, Fame's cool gaze on me makes me hear the unasked question loud and clear. "Why didn't you say anything?" But I don't have time for it. We need to get to the Invicturi. The line from the Aurelian cycle is loud in my ears. Our last hope for safety is to hope for no safety. The Hey Aurelian tradition has been to plan for such an eventuality, with a clipper ship designed for a speedy departure at the ready in a citadel's private harbour. And that's where our families are fleeing now. Really? Roxana sounds pretty drunk herself. I was thinking of making a stand. I'm about to say that's a terrible idea, when Fahmy gets there first. We're outnumbered 3-1. Eventually, they're going to run out of fun down there. She gestures at the carnage on the ground. Even slumped with the effects of drachthonasia, she's doing math. We should get out while we still can. The mainland has always been the plan. And it's our luck that Ixion is already there, waiting for us. Roxana shakes her head. Her eyes are streaming as she looks down on Norcia. For you, maybe, she says. My family has ruled this island for generations. Fahmy's glazed eyes focus on her. The fire powder, she says, her voice cooler than I've ever heard before. Why not? Roxana's jaw clenches. She turns to me. You said Thormrose cast? I have no idea what they're talking about. What? But Roxana and her Aurelian are already peeling away from us. Fahmy's skyfish has begun to lose altitude with every hacking cough. I'm not sure how much longer they'll be able to stay airborne. Dilo, says Fahmy, and I hear the fear in her voice. She'll make it. Come on. Fahmy saw Hecate can't get up to more than a coasting speed. So we drift toward the citadel and the private harbour inside, its walls sheltered by the nearest looming caste, Thornrose, whose clan we favour and recruit for our staff. The same caste I saw Amber Scales hiding on this morning. Why? I wonder again. Was Roxana asking about it? The screams of the Dragonborn fleeing, being routed by Griff and the rest of the Norsians, are distant below. And I have the briefest hope that when we clear the citadel walls, we'll find an end to the carnage. Instead, we find the private harbour in flames. The Invictori is lost in smoke. The Norsians have cut off our escape. At the sight, the last of famous Sue Hecate's strength gives out. The two of them drift and falter. They need shelter. I guide them onto the ramparts of the citadel's outer wall, deserted in the fray. Fahmy slides from her dragon's back, and I dismount from Jeff to hold her. I can see the burning harbour from where we're perched. The Norsians dragging dragonborn rolls away from their attempted escape in triumph. Ethelo and Father are stumbling as they're led. Shocks of brown skin among the olive tones of the Norsians. There's no sign of the great lord Rathamanthus or Lady Xanthi. As a dragon gasps its last, Fahmy lowers her face into the skyfish's side and sobs. It's your fault, she tells me. You and your Griff. He did this, and you let him. I hold her on the ramparts as our world burns, and know she's right.
Griff. The Haeralian clipper ship we set afire in their harbour is sleek, light, nothing but sails and Damian anti-air harpoons, and they go up like dry leaves. The painted wings of Arran, the dragon that flew Uriel to safety in the Aurelian's first exile, peel hissing from the sides. Along the prow is carved the name that, thanks to Antigone, I can now read. Invicturi. They who shall not be conquered. But now it's lost in flames. Bran and his Aurelian begin ushering the Dragonborn, who would have fled off the burning ship and onto the docks, where the Norseans wait to serve them justice. Dilo's brother, Ethelo, a Passus who rides no dragon, emerges supporting old Lady Electra's arm. The Storm Scourge widow glares at me. Ethelo just stares blankly. Griff, he says. Blood runs down his temple. I give a jaunty salute from Sparker's back. Good to see you, my lord. And then a voice speaks in Norrish, and I find Astyanax's nurse, Shay, clutching my sleeve with fire-blistered fingers. The boy's still down there. Please, Griff. The other Thornrow servants are being rounded up with about as much sympathy as the lords they betrayed the clans for, but Shay's plea plucks at me. I look from her to the burning clipper ship and think of the little Haeralian lordling who so kindly thought to spare Sparker. I try to tell myself the heir to the Haeralian line should by rights be exterminated, along with a whole lot of them for good measure. But it's no good. Shrines take all of them on my confounded heart. Keep the Dragonborn in your sights, I tell Bran, as Sparker leaps over the heads of the crowd and onto the deck of the burning clipper. I'm coughing from the smoke as soon as I dismount. Bodies are everywhere, some of them stirring, others still. Thornrow's bodies, Norsian bodies, Dragonborn bodies, the remains of bloody strife. I scramble down the ladder into the hull two rungs at a time and find flames illuminating the great lord Rhadamanthus's bloodied, crumpled head and his wife's blood-matted hair at the foot of it. Their eyes stare glassily at the ceiling. Each breath brings the smell of smoke and blood and salt water. I breathe through my mouth until I hear what I'm listening for. A child's weeping. I find Astyanax hiding in the privy 3 feet from the bodies of his parents. Griff? Little lordling, you must look at me and only me. When I lift him into my arms, he clings. I stumble up the stairs and out, coughing, to Sparker where he waits, and then we are up in the air and swooping across the distance to join the Norseans and their corralled Dragonborn on the docks. You've got to be kidding, Bran says when he sees who I've got in my arms. He's a child, Bran. He's their heir, and he's better off dead. Good thing Astyanax doesn't know a word of Norrish. There are gasps around us. People start to scream. For a moment, I think they're still fussing about the kid when I see fingers pointing toward Thornrow's karst. Roxana Haeralian is streaking toward it. For a moment, I watch, unconcerned, as Roxana's dragon prepares to fire on the clan karst, because serves Thornrow's right for the traitorous backing of the Haeralians. And then I remember what Antigone said. Aga and the little ones are hiding on that karst.
5. Thornrow's karst. Annie. We've only just cleared the dungeon, stepped onto the ramparts, and Dark taken in his first full breath of fresh air when I see it. A single triarchal dragon, conspicuous for her lack of woad, streaking away from the citadel, away from the harbour, and toward the nearest cast of Sailor's Folly. Toward Thornrow's cast. I'm on Ayla's back, in the air without a second thought. From the corner of my eye, I see Griff Suasparka burst from the citadel's burning harbour at full speed, straining for the same interception. We race them toward Thornrose. As we gain on the Aurelian rider, I recognise her. A streak of deep red hair flows from the rider's back in a braid. She has no armour, no flame suit. The dress she no doubt wore to Griff's drop is hitched around her knees. Less than 24 hours ago, I wrestled with her in the driftless dunes before her kinsmen dragged Griff away. Roxana Haeralian. now making a beeline on Dragonback for the cast where Griff's family is hiding. The bracken that provided such good coverage will also make fast kindling. Her fires start before I get there, lit from the base of the cast. The vines are brown, dried from winter, and catch quickly. The fires lick the side of the outcropping and climb. Aga will be hidden with the children at the top, among the standing stones of the shrine, surrounded by brittle undergrowth. Sparker dives into the bracken on the crown as Griff shouts his sister's name. I go after Roxana. Ayla catches the Aurelian's tail in her fangs and yanks. Roxana's dragon jerks to a halt in midair. We slam the dragon and rider into the burning bracken, smothering it. They crash into the wall of sheer rock beneath with a crack, and we pin them there like a squashed dragonfly. I have them, and I will suffocate this girl on the cast that she and her dragon set afire. But between gasps, Roxana is laughing. Such a little heroine! You're missing the bigger picture, peasant! She has to wheeze her words. I'm close to laughing too. Broken, pinned between her dragon and the rock, Roxana wants to trade insults? Even her final attempt at sabotage will be foiled by Griff, rescuing his family now from the top of the cast. Your people are routed. Your family is dead. Your line with it. Your rule is over. Between pained gasps, Roxana just keeps laughing. When you and your peasant friends crept into our lairs this morning, she says, did you not notice that dragons were missing? My fingers clench white on Ayla's reins. Her whole being is tensed to fire and waits for my wish. I won't even have to make the order aloud. And yet, what Roxana says nudges my lingering doubts. Dragons were missing. Dragons whose troughs we poisoned anyway, assuming they'd be back in time for their feeding before Griff's drop. But they still haven't shown up. She names them for me, sneering. Ixion Stormscourge. The bastards. And most important, a whale fin from Besselea. Or did you forget about Princess Freda's Goliathin? For a moment, all I can hear is the crackling of the fires creeping up the vines. I haven't seen any of them today. I should have seen them. They're coming? Hardly. Roxana leans forward and speaks between gasps. They're waiting in the great palace that you left behind, in the halls that had been taken from them, on the thrones from which they were once deposed. And I'm sure the absence of the Kallipolin first rider at the time of counter-coup was particularly appreciated. Counter-coup? Atop the cast, the shrine is almost entirely engulfed. Sparker's wings are black silhouettes as Griff rises from the flames with figures huddled in his arms. That's not possible. Roxana's laugh is wheezing. Like I said, Antigone, you're missing the bigger picture. You're so focused on winning this battle, you lost the war. I open my mouth to answer, and the wall of rock beneath us crumbles.
Griff, Aga's lungs have always been weak. Weak lungs like our mother's, that one day refused air for long enough that she fell asleep and didn't wake up. Lungs that ginger calms, but never quite eases. That can barely tolerate mists from the seas, let alone smoke. Her lungs are all I think of as Sparker scrambles through the burning bracken. I've got no flamesuit. The tunic I'm wearing will be burned off by the time we're out. But I don't stop calling her name, And then she's there, pressed against a standing stone, thrusting Garrett up to me over Sparker's wing. Then Becca. You too. Them first. Her lungs. But also the way she looked at me when she said, "This is a fantasy that will get my children killed." I take the babes into my arms. "I'll come right back for..." And then my ears shatter, and the world goes black.
D'Lo. The sound of the explosion ripples through the air and under our feet. For a moment, the scene above it is frozen. Griff saw Sparker above the flames. Two small figures suspended in his arms as he lifts them from the burning bracken. Held up to him, by hands belonging to a body I cannot see. The two Aurelians frozen. One pinning the other against the side of the cast. Crouched on the citadel walls beside Fami, I can see all of it.